Good afternoon. I'm going to call to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness. It is Tuesday, February 9th. Yeah. There we go. And we're going to open a public hearing on, what should we start with? Kenemer's, yeah. 4106. Representatives Kenemer and Gomberg, do you want to come up while she's reading us a quick summary?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4106 prohibits state agency from relying only upon expediency, convenience, best interest of public, general public need, or speculation as basis for finding of prejudice that authorizes temporary adoption, amendment, or suspension of rules. We have dash one amendments posted on OLIS that delete the requirement that agency not rely only on expediency, convenience, best interest of public, general public need, or speculation as basis for finding of prejudice that authorizes temporary adoption, amendment, or suspension of rules, and adds the requirement for all state agencies to report to Legislative Assembly annually on rules adopted.
Thank you. And just in a moment, colleagues, we have all of these people in here today, and then we have an additional overflow room. So we're not going to move any of the bills today that we're hearing for the first time. We'll carry those. We'll carry the appropriate ones over. So if we could try and keep our questions and comments limited so that we can save time for one of our major bills that has this many people waiting for us in another room. So with that, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. David Gomberg from House District 10 on the Central Oregon Coast. Thank you for your courtesy. We'll be brief in deference to the people that are behind us on other measures. I'm here today to talk about emergencies. We are beset with emergencies, and it seems like particularly in legislation, we're seeing emergency clauses creeping in with increasing frequency so that there are more bills that are emergencies than are not. But what happens when we have those bills is that the proponents appear, just as I'm appearing today, and you have the opportunity, we have the opportunity to say, what's the emergency? What's so urgent? What's going on here? That's not the case in administrative rulemaking, and the purpose of this bill is to simply ask the same question when rules are proposed. If it's an emergency, what's the emergency? Give us some detail. That being said, I'll turn this over to the chief sponsor, Representative Kenemer.
Thank you. Madam Chair, for the record, Bill Kenemer, State Representative, District 39, and proud to be a co-sponsor with Representative Gomberg. A couple of things about this is I also would like to have the dash one amendments as an addition. I think they provide extra clarity, but I wish to say our goal here is to start putting small sideboards on what I think is excessive, arbitrary, temporary emergency rules that are sometimes called temporary rules as well. I do think there is an entirely appropriate place, for example, with some of the education bills you need to make coincide with the school year. There are emergencies like forest fires and those kinds of things. This bill does not in any way, in my reading, and we have someone from Legislative Council to clarify that, verify that as well, stop that from occurring. I do think it's important that we follow the tradition that is in Oregon of being transparent, open, and fair, and allowing a public process. And I think what really brought this bill to my attention was what I considered arbitrary action by the Oregon Health OHA Authority, Oregon Health Authority, when they retroactively reduced payments to CCOs. And I think that was done without good discussion, without good process, and was arbitrary. And incidentally, I also think it's unethical to reduce things at least retroactively, although I understand that there were compelling issues from the federal government. But I do think we need to keep the process open, and we need to have a process that allows discussion and inclusion. I do think it's absurd to say that this eliminates emergency rules and takes that away, and I think, and I'd ask you to verify that with Legislative Council. And I thank you for your time, and of course, if there are questions, we have several other people who would like to testify, and I appreciate you making time for us to do this.
Absolutely. Questions? All right. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Nick.
And because we have other representatives who look like they want to testify, we are actually going to pause this hearing for a moment, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4058. And Representative Hackett, Representative McLean, are you here to testify on that as well? Oh, no. Okay. And if you want Jim to come up with you as well.
Yes, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4058 permits corporations with shares that are registered under Oregon or federal securities law to reject vote, consent, waiver, or proxy authorization if shareholder has not complied with public disclosure requirements of Oregon or federal securities law, declares an emergency as effective on passage. We have dash two amendments posted on OLIS that establish that the corporation must reject actions of all shareholders not in compliance with disclosure requirements and must accept actions once shareholders become compliant.
Thank you, Chair Fagan and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jody Hack, and I represent House District 19, which is South Salem, Almsville, and Turner. I'm here on behalf of House Bill 4058. He's looking at me from the side. I just had to give him a bad time. This bill would permit publicly held corporations to reject the vote, consent, waiver, or proxy authorization of a shareholder if they are not in compliance with the public disclosure requirements of Oregon securities law or federal securities law. Overall, this bill is a helpful tool that provides increased transparency for publicly held companies in Oregon by holding its shareholders accountable to public disclosure requirements. House Bill 4058 comes before you with proposed dash two amendments, which were just mentioned. I'm going to let Jim Bruneau speak to those amendments and to answer questions that you have on the bill for the sake of time. I was going to go through those dash twos, but I think that they were already mentioned, so I think we're fine. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Jim Bruneau. I'm the founder, president of Willamette Valley Vineyards, a very small publicly held company here in Oregon. The reason why this is important public policy is that there's more of us coming. There's more community-based publicly held corporations that are forming in Oregon. And there's one of the disadvantages of being small and publicly held is that we're very lightly traded. And as a result, our share prices can trade considerably below what the market price is. And so without proper public disclosure that's required under the federal law, it's possible for individuals to accumulate without notifying the public or the investors of their behavior. The other is, of course, is that these public requirements also apply to insiders, such as people like me, that make sure that the investors and the investing public know what we're doing in the trading of our stocks. So this public policy has been in place at the federal level for a number of years. These amendments are limited to those disclosure requirements. It simply provides public corporations the option of not counting those votes until they are properly noticed, as those shares have been properly acquired and the information has been provided through the federal notice requirements to the investing public. The problem of not proper notification through the amendments can be easily rectified by those persons making that proper public notice. Now, one of the comments that has been raised about this is that, well, it does make Oregon unique in that there's no other state that provides this optional approach to public corporations in enforcing the disclosure laws. And my response to that is that it's actually a positive, because the investing public, especially outside venture capitalists who may be interested in investing in Oregon corporations, will be able to know with more comfort that the lawful abiding behavior with respect to acquiring a public company shares has an option of being enforced here in Oregon.
Questions?
I guess just one.
Okay.
I just want to parrot back what I heard you say to make sure I understood that, which is that really you're not asking for the state of Oregon to do any more than the federal government is already doing on the federal level.
Correct.
Okay, thanks.
All right. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
And at the risk of juggling too much, I do want to let Representatives McLean and Whitsett get to their testimony as well. So we're going to pause this hearing and quickly open a public hearing on House Bill 4138. Representatives McLean and Whitsett, you want to give us a quick summary?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4138 authorizes the Legislative Assembly to request appointment of an independent counsel by joint resolution, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage.
Good afternoon, Chair Fagan and committee members. I'm bringing House Bill 4138 to you today. I'm Representative Gail Whitsett, House District 56. I developed the concept for this bill over a year ago when it was apparent that major problems existed in the executive branch of Oregon state government, and we had a governor who appeared to have no intention of being accountable for a number of potential ethics issues and potential criminal activity surrounding his immediate household. The bill was allowed a hearing last session after the governor had resigned, but we are still waiting for any information on the results of an investigation a year later. In addition to the scandals which resulted in our previous governor resigning, several agencies of the executive branch are now embroiled in a myriad of scandals in the ensuing year. To name a few which have been uncovered by the media, the Energy Department's lack of record keeping for the hundreds of millions of dollars in Betsy's, the Revenue Department's apparent lack of requiring capital gains taxes to be reported on energy tax credits, the Department of Human Services foster care facility debacle in Portland relating to years of having received abuse reports of minority children at Give Us This Day and not acting on it. All of this is in addition to the apparent extensive and ongoing scandals relating to the former governor. Oregon still has an executive branch that has the option of being non-responsive to its citizens and to the legislature if it so desires. Had the previous governor not chosen to leave office voluntarily, he would still be here. Few people understand that if the Attorney General refuses to investigate the governor's office or any of the governor's state agencies, there is virtually no recourse for the legislative branch to do so. This bill would correct that by allowing the legislative branch, by joint resolution, to request that the Attorney General conduct a cursory, preliminary investigation and then decide whether further investigation is warranted with respect to potential violations or allegations of violations identified in the joint resolution of ethics or criminal laws. In summary, the measure authorizes the Legislative Assembly to request that the Attorney General conduct a preliminary investigation regarding potential violations. The measure requires that the Attorney General shall report to the Assembly the findings of the preliminary investigation. The Attorney General is also authorized to appoint independent counsel with significant authority if they deem it necessary. I have a measure breakdown if you want it. If not, it's in the bill. I recognize that you're really pressed for time, so it's up to you, but it is in the bill, and that's the general context of it. I think that we need to do something to hold the executive branch and the agencies accountable in the event that they choose not to be responsive to the public or to us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mike McLean. I represent House District 55. I support and certainly commend the efforts of Representative Whitsitt in this regard. If the executive branch won't balance itself, it won't investigate itself, then it should be us.
Thank you, Representative. Questions for this panel? All right. Thank you both.
I think we'll just hear the opposition on this one.
Okay. With that, we're going to stay on House Bill 4138, and we have one panel. Is Aaron Knott, Michael Slauson, and Kevin? Where did Kevin go? Does he want to come up? Yeah? No? And Kevin Neely.
Very refreshing.
And can colleagues, because we are pressed for time, we're not going to move the bills that we're hearing for the first time today. So thank you for keeping your questions and comments muted. I appreciate that. Go ahead.
And Chair Fagan, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Attorney General and the Department of Justice. We will likewise keep our comments brief. The root of our concern with this bill, the way it's currently constructed, has nothing to do with holding the executive branch accountable. That is a laudable goal. It's appropriate for the legislature. The way it's written now, we are very concerned that if the legislature used this mechanism, it could actually result in prosecutions becoming impossible. And that's rooted in sort of the way it's structured. The way it's set up now, the Attorney General would be asked upon a majority resolution of the Legislative Assembly to do a 90-day preliminary investigation. And I do want to note up front that as constructed now, this could be on any crime. It's not on official misconduct or anything else that I think the legislature principally associates with public corruption. It's written any criminal matter, so it could be, you know, there's a tire factory in Pendleton that the legislature thinks needs attention. But we do that inquiry for 90 days, and at the conclusion, we have to come back and make public whatever we've done. And I've asked the head of our Criminal Justice Division and the District Attorneys Association to look at this, because I think we all stand in agreement that the disclosure of evidence prior to an indictment is something you just don't see law enforcement do. There are good reasons for that. It can lead to the destruction of evidence. It can lead to the flight of witnesses. Everybody knows exactly what you're up to, and they, for lack of a better term, lawyer up. We're especially concerned here because we've asked ourselves, what happens if the legislature wants to look into one of these serious matters? And what's been mentioned already, these are very serious matters, only to find that there was an FBI investigation already underway, a state DOJ investigation already underway, or a district attorney investigation already underway. It's very clear from the public records laws, we generally don't announce the existence of that investigation until it's robust enough to get us an indictment. And again, and you could fix this, but the way it's written now, the ability to go into any crime anywhere in the state cuts deeply into the traditional territory of our elected district attorneys. So I'll turn it over to my co-panelists.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, my name is Michael Slauson. I'm an assistant attorney general at the Department of Justice. My current assignment is an interim chief counsel of the Criminal Justice Division. I want to talk just briefly about the public disclosure provision of the bill and how it is inconsistent with our current practice in criminal law and why that's a problem. So I'll start with the confidentiality issues that we have. Typically in a criminal prosecution, there's certain information that is always retained confidential even after charging. It doesn't get disclosed to anyone, not even the defendant. And that information is typically part of the attorney-client privilege. So it's the thoughts and the impressions of the case agents and the prosecutors. That's never disclosed. This bill does not contain any provision that would keep that information confidential. The other type of information that is always confidential, except for if it violates due process rights of a defendant, is information relating to confidential informants. As you could understand, disclosing that type of information could put people in serious jeopardy. The other important aspect of this public disclosure requirement is it doesn't protect private information of victims and third parties. As you can imagine, a lot of that information is very sensitive. Some of it you can't even lawfully disclose under current law. We heard about a DHS case. We're talking about cases potentially involving child abuse and child neglect. This bill would require the public disclosure of very personal information about children. Could include graphic imagery. Information is typically protected under current law. And in fact, when and if we do have to disclose that in a criminal prosecution, prosecutors obtain protective orders, so that information is limited in its disclosure. Mr. Knott already talked about how it can impact the collection of evidence. It could also impact and disclose certain law enforcement techniques that are used in a particular investigation. You can imagine the use of undercover agents. You have a preliminary investigation, you're just getting started. 9 days into it, you're disclosing who's involved. It could compromise those individuals. We sometimes use cooperating citizens and victims. It could put them in jeopardy if their identities are disclosed or their participation in the investigation is disclosed. And lastly, the last point I want to make about this is that it could also jeopardize the right of a defendant to get a fair trial. So, for instance, in the course of an investigation, you might have a defendant take a polygraph examination, and under our evidence code, as it is around the country, those results are inadmissible in a trial. But under the provisions in this bill, those results would be made public, and the defendant is right, it has a right to have a jury consider the facts without that information. And so that is an additional concern, and that in some are generally the concerns I'd ask this committee to seriously consider before moving forward with this legislation.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kevin Neely representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. The two gentlemen on my left have really captured, I think, the gist of what the district attorneys are concerned about with this piece of legislation. Obviously, there are robust criminal laws in place. We had a long discussion this morning in your Judiciary Committee about how the criminal justice prosecution process works, and this legislation is a substantial deviation from that current process. I think that, again, Mr. Knott and Mr. Slauson have really well described some of the very concerning legal matters that are involved with this legislation. We would be happy to work with the proponents to find a way, if the goal here is to shed some light when we do have a criminal investigation, there are better ways to do that, we believe. And again, we're happy to think about what those might be. We are concerned that this bill, as it's written, is likely to imperil those investigations before they even get started.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. Aaron, maybe your best answer, have the best position to answer this question. Do you know of other states that have a legislative independent counsel capability?
Chair Fagan, Representative Bueller, do I understand correctly there a legislative counsel authority that's prosecutorial, that
yes.
has the ability to investigate and prosecute crimes?
Similar to this proposal.
That would actually be housed in the legislative
yes.
branch? I don't, and my immediate reaction, the way this is structured is careful to avoid, I think, what would otherwise be a separation of powers issue where the legislature is both writing and executing the laws. Mm. That's why I think it gives the Attorney General important discretion points, and we could quibble about them, but I think that's why it's there structurally. I would worry about separation of powers with that proposal.
Just real quickly, in the federal independent counsel statute, do any of you know how is the confidentiality issue handled with that?
Do you know that, Michael? I have. Chair Fagan, Representative Nierman, that's a good question and one that I think we'd be happy to take up if you wanted something more formal.
Okay. If you could find something on that, I'd appreciate that.
We'll look into
Maybe
it.
Maybe we can share it with the whole committee.
Sure.
Thanks.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. So that's all that I have signed up to testify on House Bill 4138. So is there anyone else? Okay, thank you. With that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 40. Excuse me. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4138. And we are still under a public hearing for House Bill 4058. And let's have Chris Hall come up. Looks like that's all that we have for that one. And if you want to give us a quick reminder, since we were in three different hearings, we're going to get a quick reminder on which bill this one is. This is the one that Representative Hack presented with Mr.
Sure.
Bonneau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 4058 permits corporation with shares that are registered under Oregon or federal securities law to reject vote, consent, waiver, or proxy authorization if shareholder has not complied with public disclosure requirements of Oregon or federal securities law, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Hi, Chair Fagan, members of the committee. My name is Chris Hall. I'm a partner with a business group at a law firm named Perkins Coie. And I'm here to ask you to really table House Bill 4058. The law really, you know, creates it's disenfranchises minority shareholders. Right? The intent is to say that people can't vote for in contested elections where management doesn't like to vote. As far as I know, as I mentioned earlier, it's really the only state in the nation to have a law of this type. And while I think Oregon, you know, can lead and certainly should lead in certain circumstances, this bill hasn't been well thought through. There's been really no time to look at it. It's been no research, as far as I know, whether it even conflicts with federal securities laws. Some particular issues with it about thwarting activist shareholders that may be coming in and want good governance. Maybe they want good pay practices. And the company would be able to decide whether there's a violation of federal securities disclosures laws. To be a little more specific about it, you know, it's not just a matter of checking a box. There is which form you file, Form 13D or 13G, which is something you guys aren't familiar with, but it's just as a nuanced determination which form. Whether a group has been formed needs to be decided. And so, for instance, the Comptroller of New York has a project. It's called the Good Governance Project, and it's going around the nation finding companies that have bad pay practices and bad corporate governance, and it says, hey, I want those to improve. So another shareholder comes along, as though they may do that. Another shareholder comes along and says, hey, I agree with you. I think those are bad pay practices, too. I'll vote the same way. Well, now do you have a group? Certainly the management's going to say you do and discount the vote. You know, these are things that shouldn't, you know, this is very highly nuanced areas. They're very technical. these statutes are drafted by securities professionals, spent a lot of time with it, and none of that's happened here. Proxy service advisors are going to be rated like other states on how well their, you know, protections are against shareholders who may be active and wanting good governance and things like that. And it's going to be a unique statute that's going to be pointed out as bad in Oregon. The thing is that these protections aren't even really needed, and the bill doesn't even do, I think, what they're purporting to do. Because what they're saying is, if a shareholder comes to vote and they haven't disclosed, and under the federal filing, where they have over 5% of shares in the company, they can't vote. Well, to vote, they need to say who they are and what shares they have, right? So you know who the shareholder is because they just told you. And they can just file the federal form at the same time. What this is, what the federal law is meant to do is give a fair warning of who's coming in, to let you know in advance who's out there doing what, and so you have time to kind of hopefully react to it all. The bill doesn't even address that, right? Because they can just file the federal form at the same time as they do the vote. For small companies, I think he's right. What you heard earlier is correct, that small companies with thinly held stock are vulnerable because shareholders can accumulate a lot of shares very quickly, which there isn't a time frame to file, and you can accumulate those shares in the time frame anyways. But what the companies do, because remember, this applies to Nike, this applies to Lithium Motors, this applies to big companies, right? And I don't know if anybody's talked to Nike and how they think their shareholders may react to something like this bill. But what you do is you put in what's called a rights plan, where if a shareholder accumulates 10% of the vote, they get penalized financially. Those are tried and true. And state law already has, and it says if a shareholder accumulates 15% of the company without permission, they can't buy the company. There's a state law already says if a shareholder acquires 20% of the company and it meets certain tests, they can't vote their shares. Those are already in state law. You can have advance notice bylaws, which say a shareholder can't show up at a shareholder meeting and just, you know, say this proposal. You just do whatever you want with this proposal. They have to give notice in advance. So management has time, the company has time to react to it. So there's a whole host of protections here for something that I think is not real well thought out at this point. It doesn't really even work the way it's drafted. It mixes federal law and state law together to give something that's not even needed at this point, or I don't think it needs protection. So I guess just ultimately, I don't think it's an emergency, as was stated in the first people that I came up here for. This stuff's been around for a long time. It's nothing new. And I really think you guys should table this discussion, table the thing until the proponents come out, could maybe get a better bill that's drafted, that's a little more nearly tightened, actually does maybe what they wanted to do. We have our public companies look at it, have Nike look at it, Lithium Motors look at it, have Metro Graphics look at it, see what they think and the way their shareholders react, because they're on, should be on the same side, right? This is their management. By the way, that's my practice, representing companies, not active shareholders. Have somebody do some research here and find out really, you know, is this going to work with federal laws or not? I don't think anybody's done that before we go out and, you know, make a name for ourselves with this bill. So I think all those things should be done, and when they are, you know, come back and revisit whether it's appropriate or not.
Thank you. And just quickly for context, because you mentioned you're with Perkins Coie, you're not a lobbyist. Can you just kind of quickly let the panel know how you came to know about the bill, just so they kind of have a little bit of context?
Yeah. I am the co-chair of the legislative subcommittee of the business law section of the bar. And so it kind of came to my attention as kind of bills float around and they say, hey, maybe, you know, someone should be thinking about this. They come to me. I'm not here on behalf of the bar because there wasn't much time. You know, we get this bill, there's not a lot of time. We have to go through certain procedures to get the bar to say yes or no. And they have a whole set of criteria of what's appropriate for us to do or not. So I'm not doing it on behalf of there. That's how it came to me. You know, since I'm not here on behalf of my firm, I'm not a lobbyist. It's just this is the area that I practice in, and so I have a lot of knowledge.
Okay. Thank you very much. Quickly, please.
Yeah, and so I just had a quick question. I may not be getting it. So the way I view it, if you follow the rules, you get to vote, right? I mean, that's the way I see it. If you don't follow the rules, you don't get to vote. That seems to be, you know, from my sensibility, seems to be a pretty fair proposition. And then there's also the -2 amendment, which allows folks that when you don't follow the rule, then if you remedy the situation, you become in compliance, then you can vote. That seems all pretty simple and fair to me. So I guess can you help me better understand what's going on for you?
Yeah, Chair Fagan, Representative Rayfield, the two aspects to that. First is what's compliant with federal law? That's a subjective question. That's the first issue. So my example of the Comptroller of New York coming out when you say, you know, you're a group or not, because that's part of what your disclosure is, not, you know, not just I own X percent, it's I'm acting with this person. So you say, well, you're this other shareholder to prove that also wants to do what you're doing, you must be a group together, you didn't file together, I'm not counting your vote. So there's the whole subjective thing for management to look at. The second is the bill, the amendment, says that you can vote as soon as you do your federal disclosure requirement. Well, what's the purpose of the federal disclosure requirement? It's to let people know that you own the shares, that you say you know whatever percent of shares over 5%. Well, the company knows that when the person comes forward to vote. Right? So what is it they're trying to address with the failure to meet your federal disclosure requirements? Right? What they want to know is that in advance, they want to know, you know, not when the vote comes up, but way up here, that these guys are accumulating shares, so when we get down here to the vote, that's an issue. So if anything, they should at least try to make the penalty something, so, you know, there's some time period you're blacked out or something like that. Because otherwise, it doesn't even do the trick. I don't know if you're following what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Chris. And it looks like this has brought up a lot of interesting issues. Again, we will have more discussion on it. We're going to carry it over for Thursday. So is there anyone else who has not been heard who'd like to be heard on House Bill 4058? Okay, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4058, and I'll carry over the work session to Thursday. All right, and with that, we're going to go back to we're still in a public hearing on House Bill 4106. So why don't you go ahead and remind us what that is, and I'll call up the first panel, which is going to be Scott Gallant, Heather Rayburn, and Courtney Johnston.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4106 prohibits state agency from relying only upon expediency, convenience, best interest of public, general public need, or speculation as basis for finding of prejudice that authorizes temporary adoption amendment or suspension of rules.
All right, go ahead.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Courtney Johnston, and I'm here today on behalf of the Coalition for a Healthy Oregon, which represents 8 organizations working with 8 of the 16 coordinated care organizations in the state. I'm here today in support of House Bill 4106. We think this bill is a very simple but necessary and important step to increasing transparency at the agency rulemaking process. There's two ways for the agency, two main processes to adopt rules. There's a regular rulemaking process, which allows for the public to play a really important role as stakeholders in the process. And there's a temporary rulemaking process, which allows rules to go into effect for 180 days immediately without public input. We think there are very important reasons to have an emergency rulemaking process. And there's, but this bill does not change any of that process. It does not impede their ability to enact emergency rules. All it does is enhance the transparency requirements for the agency when they adopt temporary rules. Right now, in that process, when an agency is required to prepare a statement of findings that its failure to act promptly will result in serious prejudice to the public interest or the interest of the parties concerned and the specific reasons for its findings of prejudice. All this bill does is simply reinforce what we believe is that legislative intent. By adding the word demonstrating before statement of findings, we're hoping to require a little more transparency around what the need to bypass the public process really is. Representative Kenemer asked me to mention that 49% of the bills in the legislature process were introduced with an emergency clause, and he introduced this bill out of concern that is a trend that's moving over to the agency side. The temporary rule process is important and valuable, but when it is being abused, it does a disservice to the public. We know this won't solve all of our problems, but we're hoping that it's a first step and a prudent first step in improving the transparency at that level. Thank you.
Chair Fagan, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm representing Family Care, members of the committee. And with me is Heather Rayburn, who also represents Family Care. And prior to her position with Family Care, she was involved in rulemaking for CMS, so she has quite a bit of experience in the rulemaking process. This bill and the Dash 1 amendments really are relatively simple for any agency to be able to implement. The Dash 1 amendments merely say that an annual report will be provided to the legislature summarizing the number of rules that are adopted, the number of temporary rules that are adopted, and the basis for those determinations. The intent is to be able to provide the legislature with information so you can see whether or not there is an increasing trend, as we believe, in using temporary rules instead of a normal rulemaking process. Why is that important? A temporary rule is adopted typically without public input, and it's effective for 6 months. So the entities who are affected by that rule have to comply with it until there is either a change or withdrawal of that rule in the process of a public hearing. So it does have a direct impact. I'll give you a couple very brief examples. One rule adopted by a state agency began last July with a temporary rule, was modified a number of times, and was eventually adopted early in January of this year, retroactive, which I've never heard of, to December 27th of last year. Very, very unusual. Another temporary rule was adopted by an agency on an issue that had been on the books and in play 3 years prior. So one might surmise that they might have had time to hold a regular rulemaking process with public input before they adopted the rule. So we would encourage you to support the Dash 1 amendments. We think it's probably going to be good public information, and it should be very easy for the agencies to do that and give you information to know how the process is actually working. One agency, for example, has adopted 46 temporary rules last year affecting Medicaid, and approximately 49 permanent rules through the normal rulemaking process. That's in the same arena, and that's not counting any other agency rules along the way. So we believe this is a worthwhile bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Can I just say for the record, too, that COHO supports the Dash 1s as well?
Thank you, Chair Fagan, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Heather Rayburn. I represent Family Care Health as the government relations manager. I think Scott and Courtney and Representative Kennemer have covered a lot of the reasons for this bill with the Dash 1 amendment. We really just want to provide accountability, transparency. We understand that temporary emergency rulemaking is important, that there are times when it's necessary, but there needs to be accountability from agencies to explain why temporary rules were the best course of action rather than the regular rulemaking process, because we are afraid that there is a trend towards using the temporary rulemaking authority as its regular rulemaking process. So we support it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments? Thank you three very much. Next panel we're going to have, my paper go. Going to have Era Atkins and Scott Susadali. Sorry. I'm horrible with these names. Are you Aaron or?
I'm Era.
Era. Okay, Scott.
For House Bill 4122.
Yeah, she's on
4122. Okay, well, she's 4102. Okay,
so
no problem, not a problem, very confusing. Is Scott also on
Scott, are you in the room? Are you also intending to testify on? We'll make sure that you get heard, ma'am. We'll just move it to the next one. Okay. So with that, we will go on to Aaron Knott, Renee Mouvon, and Shannon Hearn. And this is still on 4106. This should be our last panel on 4106.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Attorney General and the Department of Justice. We are neutral on House Bill 4106, but we had a few remarks. We always come to this through the lens of what's likely to happen in terms of litigation, and I am happy to report that the Dash 1 solved about 90% of our concerns. Does a very good job of taking the same priority, and instead of creating an opportunity for litigation as to whether we relied purely on convenience or what have you, provides the legislature with the information the legislature needs to hold these agencies to their burden in terms of making sure they're promulgating temporary rules the right way. We have one remaining concern, and it falls into the same category. We think there could be an effect, an increasing effect on the amount of legislation just trying to figure out what it means. And it's only one word. That word is demonstrating. It appears on line 22 of page 3. Right now, the law says that an agency is obligated to post a statement of its findings that its failure to act promptly will result in serious prejudice to the public interest. That's the standard now. The only change proposed by this bill is inserting the word demonstrating instead of stating it now must be demonstrated. The Court of Appeals is likely to find that that phrase was meant by the legislature to increase the factual burden on agencies across all temporary rulemaking processes. That's a fairly serious change. You'll be looking at litigation trying to figure out what did the legislature mean by demonstrating. The reason I highlight it here is I'm not entirely sure this is an intentional or certainly not central effect of the legislation as you've been discussing it. And so I think the safer course, if that isn't at the heart of what you want to do today, would be another amendment taking that word out. Outside of that, the Dash 1s really do bring this to a place where the Department of Justice can be satisfied with it. I have no further remarks.
Thank you.
Oh, I should mention, Ms. Mouvon is an AAG who specializes more in this, so there are universes of technical questions that would stump me, so she is here for that purpose.
Do you want to go? Chair Fagan, members of the committee, I'm available if you have any questions. Otherwise, I have no testimony.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Shannon Hearn. I'm the Deputy Director for Fish and Wildlife Programs. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on House Bill 4106 today. I was just going to give you a little perspective of the temporary rule framework that we use at the Department of Fish and Wildlife. When we're writing our justifications for a significant number of temporary rules, it's usually in the best interest of the public or to protect the resources, the justification that we use. Upon review of the last 2 years of temporary rules, we found they kind of fit into four categories: correction of inadvertent errors, implementation of settlement or negotiated agreements, rule changes to correct unintended or negative outcomes, as well as closures or modifications to opportunity in response to emergency situations. Hunting opportunity is often reduced or expanded by temporary rule to increase the use or protect the resource following a fire, disease outbreak, change of access, some major issue like that. This includes reinstating preference points for successful applicants in the controlled hunt draw following a significant forfeiture of hunting opportunity. Negotiated settlement agreements and government-to-government relationship consultations with tribe often result or warrant immediate action and involve temporary rulemaking. Examples of that are the annual tribal fishing and hunting opportunities that we negotiate in season, as well as the 2013 gray wolf settlement agreement required immediate temporary rule response. Temporary rules often provide the ability to maximize fishing opportunities within our conservation mandates. As an example, permanent rules for salmon and steelhead fishing on the Columbia River are more conservative than what we typically implement annually. Modifications to liberalize these fisheries are made using temporary rules based on best available science, in particular in-season assessments of stocks. If temporary rules are adopted if temporary rules adopted in the best interest of the public were restricted, and given the uncertainties we now have in ocean conditions and climate as well, the agency would be forced in many circumstances to rely upon standard and more conservative permanent rules to implement hunting and fishing opportunity. At a minimum, this would result in reduced fishing opportunities in all Columbia River fisheries that sport commercial tribal ocean salmon, ocean nearshore fish species, etc. We did look at the Dash 1 amendments and recognize that these qualifiers on the restrictions potentially would be removed, so we appreciate that consideration. We also looked at the reporting, and we, through the Secretary of State's office, in developing the justifications and the certificate of inclusion, we're doing our best to demonstrate the reasons behind these temporary rules. Again, the ambiguity there could cause some issues. On the reporting side of things, documenting side of things, we're trying to do our best internally to compile that information and get it out at our commission meetings, as well as post the temporary rules on the webpage. We think through that process with the Secretary of State and what we're doing internally, we could probably meet the reporting requirement pretty efficiently.
Just out of curiosity, Mr. Knott, how often are administrative rules contested?
Chair Fagan, Representative Rayfield, it is in this moment that I am pleased that I had the foresight to bring someone up with me. So I will punt that question.
Chair Fagan, Representative Rayfield, Renee Mulan. In my experience, administrative rules are not challenged that often, but emergency rules are more likely to be challenged because often an agency will need to make a split second decision, and it is startling for the public, and sometimes it is not a happy decision for the public. I can think of instances, for example, where quarantines are enacted in order to prevent the spread of plant and animal diseases, and those are very significant rules that will make people unhappy. And so in this, in these kinds of situations, we're concerned that the original bill would chill the ability of an agency to respond to an emergency because there could be a lot of litigation over what these terms mean and what the application of the terms to the situation are.
I just have
one. Okay, very quickly, Representative McLean and then Representative Bueller.
This was to your comment, Erin, on the demonstrating word, that terminology. Do you believe that that sentence, taking that word out, still is going to give the merit of the bill itself an opportunity to function?
Chair Fagan, Representative McLean, I do. The Dash 1 amendments are a separate mechanism outside of litigation to provide the legislature with good information about what temporary rules are being made, why they're being made, who they're impacting. Our concern in coming in was mostly to make sure that the non-litigation path was taken if available because it's cheaper, and so we're just here to avoid adverse effect on litigation. So I think the answer is yes.
Okay.
Representative Bueller.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. Renee, maybe you're best to answer this question. Are major administrative rules ever reviewed for their unintended effects after being implemented?
Chair Fagan, Representative Bueller, is that after they've implemented?
Yes.
I think that oftentimes an agency will proceed with a temporary rulemaking and at the same time they will convene a permanent rulemaking proceeding. And so if questions come up, you know, after a temporary rule has been implemented and enacted about unintended consequences, then the agency is well positioned to respond to that in the permanent rulemaking. Now, they don't always have parallel tracks. But in the instances where they do have parallel tracks of a temporary rule and a permanent rulemaking, there is an opportunity to assess those unintended consequences that stem from an emergency rule. If an agency is promulgating an emergency rule without the intent of having a permanent rulemaking, I think that in my experience, if an agency becomes aware of unintended consequences as a result of that temporary rule, they will work to amend the temporary rule with another temporary rule, or they will convene a permanent rulemaking to address that.
Quick follow-up.
Very quickly, please.
What about review of final administrative rules, not necessarily temporary?
Chair Fagan, Representative Bueller, in my experience, if an agency becomes aware of unintended consequences as a result of a permanent rulemaking, they will take that into consideration, and depending on when they're next going to convene a permanent rulemaking, they could address that in their next permanent rulemaking. If it was serious enough, they could convene another rulemaking to address that concern.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to, is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on House Bill 4106? Okay, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing, House Bill 4106. And colleagues, again, because we are facing, one of our bills has lots of testimony, we're going to, I'm going to carry over the work session on House Bill 4106 to Thursday, and we will have an opportunity for discussion during the work session. So there will be questions we can ask certain people to come back if you'd like people that are in the building to come back. So I don't mean to squelch the debate. We just want to make sure that the folks who are not in the Capitol every day have a chance to get heard. So with that, I'm going to, so I've already carried over the work session for House Bill 4106. I'm going to carry over the work session for House Bill 4065 to Thursday. And with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4122. And go ahead and give us a summary. And Holdy, do you want to go?
I'm here.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4122 allows local government to inhibit or prevent production or use of seed or seed products for purpose of protecting seed or seed products that are not genetically engineered from adverse impacts of genetically engineered seed or products. We have the -3 amendments posted on OLIS that replace the measure with labeling requirements for genetically engineered fish destined for human consumption and direct the State Department of Agriculture to adopt rules and establish effective dates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, State Representative Paul Holvey, House District 8. I am the sponsor of this legislation, and I bring it forward to the committee for consideration. This comes about after conversations with many in my community who buy organic food, and they also have a lot of farming that is organic as well. And there is also a lot of seed farmers that both conventional and organic who are concerned about contamination from genetically engineered crops in neighboring fields. As you may recall, in the special session, there was a, in 2013, there was a Senate Bill 863, which took away local government's ability to put in place some restrictions on those types of crops and having that local control. Since that time, many farmers and many consumers have all contacted me about this and didn't feel like this issue has been adequately addressed by the Department of Agriculture since the passage of that bill, or that there is a process in place that will protect them from potential contamination, which could destroy their crops. There'll be many other people who can elaborate on that much more better than I can and answer all the questions. There are, I think there's other amendments on OLIS that do have a separate amendment that talks about genetically engineered fish and the requiring labeling of those genetically engineered fish. I think it's incumbent upon the state to act on this. As it, you know, EPA has approved, which is in the process still, but they have approved a genetically engineered salmon, which causes concern of many people, and they've approved it for food, though I think that has been suspended for the time being. But I think it's incumbent upon us to join the state of Alaska and a few other states in requiring label of genetically engineered fish, just to make sure consumers have, you know, confidence in the fish that they buy. And I think that not being able to understand those differences could undermine their confidence. And certainly, I think the fishing industry as well also is concerned about confusion in this space. Whether it's between regular farm fish or wild fish, it's still important for the consumer to know. So that is the sort of the substance of that fish. There are some exemptions in the bill that could come out later. It doesn't apply to shellfish or triploids or medicines, and it does not apply to restaurants. It's only at the wholesale and consumer or retail spaces. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. So I'm going to call up our first panel, and then I'm going to give a quick explanation of how we're going to do this. We have 26 people who want to testify, so we're going to need to all work together to try and make sure everybody's heard. So first, the people that came from over 100 miles, so Brett Diamond, Chris Hardy, and Kent Nock. And colleagues, just like the other ones, we're not going to work this bill today. So if we could try and not ask questions from the dais and just make sure that people have an opportunity to be heard. And to the extent that the numbers are there, I'm going to alternate panels of for and against so that there's kind of a balanced conversation going forward. And if I could ask you to try and keep your remarks to 2 minutes. We don't have any kind of light system up here. I'll have a timer up here, and I'll try to gently interrupt if you're going over 2 minutes. So with that, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Fagan and members of the committee. My name is Brett Diamond. I'm here today in support of HB 4122 for several important reasons. I'm a beekeeper in Lane County and an anthropologist who works with farmers all over the world. As some of you may know, Glory Bee Honey from Eugene recently acquired organic and non-GMO verified certification for their honey products, the very first company in the world to achieve this milestone. And it was not an easy endeavor. It took them over 5 years to make it happen. We couldn't be prouder of Glory Bee. They are a wonderful company with an excellent reputation of providing high quality products and giving back to our community. But as happy as we are to hear of their success in becoming non-GMO verified, there is a certain level of sadness that comes with the announcement. The sad truth is not a single drop of their non-GMO verified honey comes from Lane County. Not a single drop of their non-GMO verified honey comes from Oregon or even the Pacific Northwest. Indeed, not a single drop of this non-GMO verified honey even comes from the United States. It is all imported. Why? Because in order to attain non-GMO verified status, the hives must be placed at the center of an 8-square-mile buffer zone that is documented to be GMO free. Bees routinely travel 4 to 6 miles when they forage for pollen and nectar, but some do go even farther. And to ensure non-GMO status, an 8-mile fly zone is required. Sadly, there is no non-GMO verified honey currently produced in the U.S. because there simply are no 8-square-mile bee fly zones within the United States that have sufficient food source for bees, but no GMO crops. While Lane County could create these non-GMO bee fly zones, we are currently forbidden from doing so under SB 863. Organic agriculture is growing at a tremendous rate. According to the USDA in 2014, there were over 14,000 organic farms in the U.S. producing $5.5 billion in Oregon products. While Oregon ranked 9th in the number of organic farms, we ranked 4th in sales of organic crops, producing $237 million of organic products.
Thank you, Brent. That's 2 minutes. Brett, sorry. I want to make sure everybody gets heard, but thank you. And you can submit any testimony written if you want to submit your written testimony so that your full testimony is in the record. Go ahead.
Thank you, Representative Fagan. My name is Chris Hardy. I'm a farmer from Southern Oregon, and I'm here because I support HB 4122. I'm also a board member of the Southern Oregon Sea Growers Association, and or SOSCA, and will offer several comments just about SOSCA's position and nothing about the legislation. We do not oppose genetically engineered crops, for the record. I support HB 4122 because I think local farmers and governments have the right to protect themselves from the raising of genetically engineered crops and protect themselves from contamination. 4122 allows for local democratic process and has nothing, as it relates to GMOs, nothing more, nothing less. If genetically engineered crops stayed where they are planted, I would not likely be here today, but they don't. If my seed crop is contaminated by pollen from genetically engineered crops, I'm breaking federal patent law, and if I try to sell this or if I try to replant them. Also, I don't know of any any buyers that would like, that would prefer to buy tainted crops, that would basically ruin my markets and my customers' interest to work with me in the future. In 2012, I was growing beet and Swiss chard for a contract, and there was a Swiss company who grew genetically engineered sugar beets nearby me, and that resulted in me having to make the decision whether or not to destroy my crop. And I did, not knowing the outcome of many months of work that I would have put into producing that crop, not knowing whether it would have any market value or not, according to our contract buyer. Also, on behalf of Saska, I can say that the organization believes there is no realistic basis for saying that farmer-to-farmer communication or pinning a voluntary system would adequately protect farmers who grow traditionally crops from genetically engineered crops. The argument real local laws aren't needed sounds good, but it isn't true. As a farmer growing traditional crops, I hope you can support 4122 House Bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Perfect. 2 minutes exactly.
Hello. My name is Kent Nock, and I'm from Rogue River in Jackson County. And I am here in support of 4122, but I don't want to present a lot of points. I have only one point, and that is, if it is possible to ban bans on a statewide basis, and we have people that want to grow non-contaminated crops, who really benefits? There are many players in this game. There are large corporations. There are the public that wants to eat good food. And there are even people far outside of Oregon that depend on Oregon to produce good non-GE seed. So who really benefits if it's possible to prevent local localities from just producing this in-demand non-GE seed? Who benefits?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So next, from those who've identified in opposition to the bill, we're going to start with Dan Chen, because he's traveled more than 100 miles, and then Greg Loberg and Scott Dahlman. And please try and keep it to 2 minutes as well. Thank you.
Hello. Dan Chen.
Okay. So Greg and Scott, are they not out there? Okay, go ahead.
I'm not from more than 100 miles.
No, that's okay.
So,
oh, there's only one person. I'm trying to bring up panels of three to avoid transition time.
Thank
so,
you.
Okay, go ahead.
Hello, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm a grower from Klamath Falls, Oregon, third-generation potato farmer from Klamath Falls, Oregon. We grow potatoes, grain, wheat. We grow 75% of our potatoes are organic production, and about 50% of our wheat is organic production. We believe in GE as part of the program to help the world, help us supply the world with food. We will not be able to have enough food for the world by not having GMO food. My thought is, if you look at really the science of GE food, no one's got sick over it. There isn't any major problems with GMO seed, GMO food. But there is a big hype about it, and I believe too that, and this is from experience in growing crops. It's tough to grow organic production. I can tell you it's challenging. It's as far as yields and all that. It's challenging to get the yields in that, and So, but I do it because I like to do the, I like the ground, I like to do it the natural way. But I believe there is a spot for that food. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Fagan and committee members, thanks for having me here today. Greg Loberg, I'm the manager of West Coast Beet Seed Company here in Salem, Oregon. I'm the president of the Oregon Seed Association, and I'm the public relations chair of the Willamette Valley Specialty Seed Association. I'm here to oppose House Bill 4122. I look at this as detrimental to Oregon. It's not about coexistence, it is about exclusion, and I think it hurts the state. Senate Bill 863 was mentioned already. We have placed properly regulatory of crops at a state level and have preempted local governments from creating restrictions that would defeat quality coexistence. We have pesticide preemption that's over 20 years old and has been similarly successful. I was part of the governor's task force that looked at this issue for a year in 2014. No recommendations were made. We simply reestablished that we have ideological differences around farming systems and crop types. I was part of a work group last year in 2015 in regular session in which we again worked on legislative possibilities around this issue. Out of that came a mediation bill, House Bill 2509. And recently, the Oregon Department of Ag has asked many stakeholders, including me, to attend a rulemaking session next week to flesh out the way that 2509 should be implemented. So I look at the support for 4122 as providing preferential treatment and exclusivity. We have at least two growers that produce for us who produce organic production, conventional, and biotech crops. We are used to working with coexistence with many seed companies on a daily basis. So again, on behalf of the Oregon Seed Association, the Willamette Valley Specialty Seed Association, I oppose adding any restrictions such as those found in House Bill 4122. Thank you.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Dahlman. I'm the policy director for Oregonians for Food and Shelter. I'm not in front of this committee much, so as a reminder, Oregonians for Food and Shelter represents farmers, foresters, and other technology users across Oregon on issues involving pesticides, fertilizer, and biotechnology. We are here to oppose House Bill 4122 because it divides Oregon agriculture. Instead of promoting the coexistence that we should be, we believe that Oregon's agricultural diversity is what makes it special in Oregon. We've got over 200 types of crops here, and that's amazing, and we're lucky to have that. And that's what makes it special. They all use different methods, conventional, organic, biotech, but there's room for all of it in Oregon. Because of this diversity, though, coexistence is key, and that's whether you're growing GE crops or not. Coexistence issues do arise, and Oregon farmers have worked together to manage those issues for generations and should continue to be able to do so. So we support anything that encourages coexistence. There are different seed associations where pinning is done, those types of methods. We also support the bill that was passed just 8 months ago, which sets up a program through Department of Agriculture for farmers who have concerns about coexistence to be able to go with a mediator and work their issues out. There's lots of ways that cross-pollination could be avoided with pollination timing, physical barriers, different distances, but farmers need to work out that between themselves, not have voters work it out at the ballot box deciding what a farmer can or cannot grow on their own property. This has a built-in supposition that GE crops are somehow more dangerous than other crops, but they are evaluated by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And before they are released, the USDA says they are no more dangerous to any neighboring crops than non-GE crops. I see I'm running out of time here. Happy to answer your questions.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. All right, with that, we're going to have Era Atkins, Don Tipping, and Mary Middleton. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Fagan and representatives. I apologize for that earlier. That was my fault.
My name is Era Atkins, and I'm here in support of House Bill 4122. I'm an organic farmer, and I'm also here to represent the Rockford Grange. We're the largest growing grange in Oregon, and our members are composed of both conventional and organic growers. And we unanimously are in support of this bill. We want to protect, we want the freedom to protect our traditional crops and heirloom varieties from cross-pollination and contamination by GE crops. These traditional and heirloom varieties have stood the test of time. And I just want to acknowledge that, you know, the GMO issue is very contentious and divisive, and but the fact stands that we do not have long-term evidence. I mean, they haven't been around long enough for us to know for sure about their safety. And we are asking for the ability to protect these pockets of genetic diversity, biodiversity, these varieties that have stood the test of time for many generations. I mean, I grow a pole bean that's called Old Mother Stallard, and it came over to the country sewn into the hem of a lady's skirt. This was in the 1800s. This variety went through the summer heat and less than the ideal amount of water, and was prolific and reliable. And I don't want to see these old heirlooms threatened, because our survival of us as a species may depend on them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, good day, Madam Fagan, Chair, and all assembled here. My name is Don Tipping, and I'm an organic seed grower and seed company owner in Southern Oregon in Josephine County. I've been earning a living as a farmer for the past 20 years as a certified organic grower. We contract with growers in both Jackson County and Josephine County and beyond to produce organic seed for us, all certified organic, through the Oregon Department of Agriculture Certified Organic Program. So we're required through our organic certification to be producing non-GMO seed. So I have a vested interest in this economically, and represent the vested economic interest of about 15 other organic farmers. We lose value when we have a GMO contamination event, of which I've had happen twice, through contamination through pollen and planting stock seed, where we lost money directly, and as have our other growers. Oregon's a world-class seed growing region, and it's also organic is the fastest growing sector of agriculture here in Oregon, with an increase in 93% of value in between 2008 and 2014, as somebody stated earlier, to almost $240 million in organic produce last year. GMO testing places the burden upon small family farmers, in particular organic growers, where we have to test our seed lots to ensure their purity in order to comply with the organic regulations as per the USDA National Organic Program. Senate Bill 863 is inconsistent with other phytosanitary agricultural regulations nationwide and does not encourage agriculture to thrive amidst the diversity of regionally unique agriculture. We have tried to assemble a pinning system down in Southern Oregon, and Syngenta, we were invited them to participate. They're the primary people behind getting GMO sugar beets grown, and they would not cooperate with us. So,
hi, my name is Mary Middleton, and I'm the director of Oregonians for Safe Farms and Families. It's based in Josephine County. In Josephine County, we believe that the SB 863 Oregon Seed Bill is unconstitutional. Josephine County is currently in the midst of a lawsuit brought by a biotech-funded effort to overturn our GE crop ban. OSFF is an intervener in the case, and we are standing to defend the will of the people and protect the small family farmers and our premier seed-growing region in the Rogue Valley. We welcome HB 4122 because we believe it will right the wrong that SB 863 created, and that is simply what it will do. Unlike a court order, this legislative action sends a strong message to the out-of-state corporate interests that champion the seed preemption bill. That message is that our Oregon's premier seed-growing regions and the integrity of our heritage seeds are not for sale. The passage of HB 4122 will show Southern Oregon seed citizens that the legislature is listening to the will of the people. After all, in May of 2014, the majority of both Josephine and Jackson County citizens overwhelmingly voted to protect family farmers and ban GE crops in both counties. Together, this created the largest GE-free zone in the Pacific Northwest. The passage of this bill will embrace the GE-free zone and protect the farms, the farmers, our heritage seeds in the Rogue Valley, southwestern Oregon, and throughout the state. It will also return agricultural decisions to local government. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we're going to have Jerome Rosa, Anna Scharf, and Angie Blacker. And while they're coming up on deck, we have Ray Seidler, Jared Waters, and Ann Barblinger. So you'll be up next. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead.
Oh, you want me to start? Sorry. I thought you would go in orders as you called it. So, Chair Fagan and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Angie Blacker, and I am the executive director of the Oregon Seed Association and the Willamette Valley Specialty Seed Association, all companies based right here in Oregon. In 2013, the Oregon legislature passed Senate Bill 863, preempting local governments from imposing restrictions on crops, especially those that are genetically modified or engineered. Subsequently, the governor formed a diverse statewide task force that met many times through 2014. The purpose of this task force was to reduce conflicts between biotech and conventional crops. House Bill 2509 was passed last session with the goal of strengthening coexistence among farmers in Oregon, but now less than a year after passage of House Bill 2509, which has not yet been fully implemented, House Bill 4122 proposes an abrupt shift in course for Oregon's ag industry. Local governments do not have the expertise or resources to properly regulate the agriculture industry. The Associated Oregon Counties supported Senate Bill 863 in 2013 because they recognized the complexity and difficulty in regulating the seed industry. Potential local restrictions impair the seed industry by making future seed production opportunities subject to limitations and bans. Predictability of quality seed production is paramount to the terrific international reputation that the Oregon seed industry prospers from. Senate Bill 863 ensured the industry would be operating on a level playing field throughout the state, and attempts to restrict coexistence rather than support it are counterintuitive to all of the work that has been put forth so far today. This industry needs to be regulated at the state level. For that reason, on behalf of OSA and WVSSA, I do ask that you consider the devastating effects that House Bill 4122 would have on Oregon's second largest industry. Thank you.
Chair Fagan and members of the committee, my name is Anna Scharf, and I'm here today on behalf of Scharf Farms, a family-owned and operated farm in Polk County for over 100 years. Last year, our farm grew 10 different varieties of grass seed, 4 different varieties of wheat, 2 different varieties of clover, 2 different brassica crops, wine grapes, hazelnut, and silage corn. No partridge in a pear tree. Those are best left in the Hood River Valley. The only GE crop we had was silage corn grown for a local dairy. The ground where the corn was grown is ground that has proven that it can't grow much of anything without costly additives of chemicals and fertilizers. It also has no water and sits on a hill that is prone to erosion. Frankly, I wish we could quit farming this hill, but we rent the ground from an elderly gentleman who relies on it to supplement his retirement income. He's grateful for that additional income and thankful that we found a crop that finally works on his land. We as farmers rely on Oregon State University and their ongoing expert research to continually determine the appropriate isolation distances for growing the wide variety of crops that we have. We rely on the Oregon Department of Agriculture to oversee all of Oregon agriculture evenly and equitably and find ways to bring new crops and existing crops together fairly and safely. And some farmers with specialty seed crops use private pinning systems through the Willamette Valley Specialty Seed Association to manage crop isolation and rotation. Bottom line is, successful ag management tools are already in place. Farmers are using them and have for hundreds of years. And cities and counties are not equipped to micromanage which crops should and should not be grown in the state of Oregon. I urge you to take a no vote on House Bill 4122. Thank you.
Chair Fager, members of the committee, my name is Jerome Rose. And I'm the executive director of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, Oregon's largest agricultural industry. OCA is the voice of the cattle industry in Oregon. Our most pressing concern for OCA is House Bill 4122 contains an emergency clause, potentially allowing counties to take immediate action in regulating crops and thereby ranchers' fields and pastures. Ranchers often graze cattle in pastures containing perennial crops like alfalfa, ryegrass, or clover. If 4122 is passed, it could force many producers to tear up their crops that are already planted, resulting in a total loss for them with no compensation. GE seed is often a large upfront investment that farmers recoup by the lower input costs over the life of the crop. If a farmer is forced to remove that crop, as many local measures have proposed, it could result in significant losses for those growers. Further, it would require producers to scramble to find adequate alternatives for feeding animals that don't require overgrazing and meet nutritional needs of their animals. For some feed crops, over 90% of the available seeds are GE, leaving few alternatives if these crops aren't available. If House Bill 4122 creates a range of risks and potential expenses, not just for primary growers, but for the livestock producers dependent on such crops. OCA is also concerned with allowing each local entity to enact seed regulations, creating a paperwork of regulations across the state. To the budgetary constraints on our local government, we are concerned that the level of analysis and scientific scrutiny such regulations have before enactment. The seed and other products we use to feed cattle, as well as the beef we produce, are currently regulated by the United States Department of Ag, FDA, and EPA, all of which have the needed expertise and scientific data to make informed decisions on safety. Finally, this patchwork of regulations will unduly burden producers on an individual level. Livestock and dairy producers determine which crops to plant based on what they need to feed their herds a nutritious, balanced diet. It's not uncommon for grazed land and pastures to span across multiple county and city jurisdictions. Under this patchwork of local regulations, individual producers would be forced to contend with multiple regulations across their properties or purchase more expensive alternative forages for an entire operation just to comply with one jurisdiction's ordinance or code. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Next up, we're going to have Ray Seidler, Jared Waters, and Ann Barblinger. And on deck is Julie Fergula and Helen Rudenclaw. Go ahead. Go ahead.
My name is Dr. Ray Seidler, and I live in Ashland. I have a PhD in microbiology, and that experience will be reflected today. I went to work for the U.S. EPA, United States Environmental Protection Agency, and there I was a chief scientist in charge of the biosafety program for evaluating genetically engineered crops. So I have about 30 years' experience on this topic. In 1994, I helped put together an international meeting, a symposium involving about 50, 60 scientists from around the world, and almost everyone expressed in that symposium a concern in the future about cross-pollination between genetically engineered crops and natural or conventional or organically grown crops. And I thought, since I haven't heard this, and I was also used to be a teacher, I want you to know that GMO, GE, genetically engineered, genetically modified, all mean the same thing. What the heck is a genetically engineered crop, and how does it differ from conventional crossbreeding? Well, let me say that. Natural cross-pollination involves transfers of thousands of genes on about 20 chromosomes, typically, in higher plants. And that cross-pollination happens between the same species or very closely related species. The sexual reproduction has evolved over the millennia and involves special differentiated tissues and cells. On the other hand, GE, or genetically engineered crops, are made by humans in a laboratory. Not natural, and it's really an asexual reproduction process.
Thank you very much.
The genes...
Thank you. That's two minutes. Thank you. Sorry. You can, if you could submit the rest as written testimony, that would be great. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to thank everybody for listening to me today, a seventh-generation Oregonian farmer. My family's been farming in Oregon since Oregon was just a territory. I'm a Republican, non-organic farmer.
Excuse me, sorry. Can you state your name for the record?
Jared Waters. I'm a Republican, non-organic farmer, and I once thought that GMO crops were the way of the future and touted them as such. Then I grew GMOs for several years and learned more about them. I likely grew one of the largest crops of GMOs in the county I live in. I saw other farmers have crops contaminated by their neighbors and lose lots of money having to destroy their hard work. Then when GMO wheat escaped a test plot in part of Oregon hundreds away, miles away from me, it shut down all exports of Oregon wheat. This had far-reaching effects, for the farm I was managing lost over $50,000 when these exports stopped. Pollen can travel long distances, up to 5 miles, especially in windy areas. GMO pollen can cross property lines and contaminate another crop. I see this as trespass, and there's nothing I can do about it. In an ideal world, farmers can work together, but ultimately people are stubborn and will do as they please. I should not put others at risk of losing their crop due to this contamination. No farmer can legally sell a crop that has been contaminated by GMO pollen, as that is a violation of federal patent law. GMO manufacturers may claim they won't sue, but their track record of doing so speaks for itself. The Oregon wheat scare was not alone. Wheat showed up in another place in 2014 where it was not supposed to be. Hay exports have also been affected by this as well. The year before last, the exports of Pacific Northwest alfalfa were stopped when such contamination was found. I believe the only way to protect Oregon farmers growing traditional crops is by having local control. Only the local government knows its agricultural condition and knows what's best in their area. Oregon is a home rule state, and that is part of the way Oregon was founded, and we need to retain that. Local government can adopt and it can adapt to protect its farmers from the dangers GMOs present. Jackson and Josephine counties had this bipartisan support in passage of their measures doing such. I want my son and his children to have the opportunity to grow traditional crops here in Oregon without the risks of contamination. Once we lose our traditional crops, we can't get them back. Please protect Oregon farmers' rights by voting yes on HB 4122.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Ann Berblinger. I'm a farmer in Gales Creek in western Washington County. We grow more than 300 varieties of more than 300 varieties of herbs and vegetables, and I've submitted, I guess for the record, a little sample. The six kinds
of
kale.
It's on
Olus. The seed for that kale comes from two Oregon companies, Wild Garden Seed in Philomath and Adaptive Seed in near Sweet Home, Oregon. Those are some of our just beautiful, attractive things, and the part of our competitive advantage is having that kind of variety and diversity in our crops. I've been a farmer for 16 seasons, but before that was my second career. I quit my day job in 2007, so I'd overlap for a little while. But before that, I did economic development. And one thing I learned from economic development is that the first principle of economic development is to work with, protect, and enhance the opportunities for success of your existing local businesses, particularly those that are dynamic and growing and innovative, like our organic farms and many of the seed companies that have been represented here today. To put them at risk in order to create an opportunity for a kind of economic activity that happens all over the place is really a stupendous blunder. Last summer, we watched while the farm across the street was spraying a pesticide from a helicopter, and we sat there with biting our fingernails. There wasn't a breath stirring. They knew what they were doing. They were following the rules. It was safe. We're safe from pesticides, and for that reason, and if we are subject to pesticide drift, we have some recourse. If we lose some of our own crops that we've developed and the seeds we saved from them, there's no recourse, and that's a loss that's forever, not just for one season.
Thank you very much. Next up, we'll have Julie Furtwine, Helen Rudenclaw, and on deck is Ivan Maluski, Amy Van Son, and Elise Sleegley. Man, I'm just struggling today.
It's hard to read printing now. You don't make so much fun of me.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. Hello, my name is Julie Fergala. I'm the pre-commercial manager from Beta Seed, Inc. Beta Seed is the leading sugar beet seed producer in North America. We've been producing sugar beets in the Willamette Valley since 1972, and we're committed to Oregon. In 2012, we underwent a four-and-a-half-year, $41 million investment project to upgrade our seed processing facility in Tangent, Oregon. We employ 70 full-time people, and during the busy season can employ up to 150 additional temporary labor. We are accredited through an industry-wide certification called Excellence Through Stewardship. ETS ensures that we have adequate standard operating procedures in place to maintain the integrity of our product. Our product is 100% GE. We do not have the option to produce conventional because our customers do not demand it. There have been no reported financial losses from an organic or other seed producer by a GE crop in the Willamette Valley. We also pin our fields and abide by Willamette Valley Specialty Seed Association bylaws. We've been able to coexist in Willamette Valley for over 40 years. Legislators should not let emotional bills affect what is right for Oregon. If passed, using examples set by Jackson and Josephine County, we'd be forced to produce seed outside of Oregon. Beta Seed's annual operating income is around $32 million, most of which is kept locally. Beta Seed has built long-term and trusting relationships with growers who would lose their sugar beet crops in their rotation. Beta Seed supports the local community through Salvation Army, holiday donations, Race to End Poverty, Sir Optimist Walk, Albany Big Pickup, Keeping Albany Streets Clean, Hood to Coast, just to name a few. We are the community. We are the names and faces, the mothers and fathers. Overturning a preemption law established in 2013 does not make sense for Oregon. Please support us in voting no on House Bill 4122.
Thank you.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, my name is Hele Rudenclaw, and I'm here today to urge you to vote no on House Bill 4122. My husband and I have a family farm in Yamhill and Polk counties. We raise 8 to 10 different crops each year, which include both GE and non-GE crops. I have a master's in plant breeding genetics and crop science from OSU, and to me, the plant breeding method used to develop a crop is less important than the specific trait that variety contains. For example, we've grown wheat, which carried resistance to a certain herbicide. This trait was developed by treating seeds with a mutagen, but by definition, this is not a GE crop. The GE crops we have tried include a small trial of Roundup Ready soybeans. We've grown Roundup Ready field corn and produced Roundup Ready sugar beet seed. We are seed growers. That is our specialty. We are acutely aware of the requirements for seed purity and how to maintain those standards. For most seed crops, those requirements are laid out in the Certified Seed Handbook with specifications for each type of certified seed produced in Oregon. If your neighbor plants a field of the same type as yours, you may have to leave a buffer strip which cannot be marketed with the rest of the seed to ensure the genetic purity of the main lot. This is an economic disadvantage to us, but something which all certified seed growers deal with, and we're not going to get an argument with our neighbor over it. For other seed crops we grow, the system is a little different. Well before we started farming, the specialty seed growers in Willamette Valley got together and agreed to a unique system of pinning to ensure genetic purity of their crops. In our case, we grow an open-pollinated white sprouting radish for the Japanese market. This must be isolated from other radishes. Now that we've grown white radish in a certain area for a number of years, we essentially have priority or seniority. However, if one year we choose not to grow it, another farmer or company can come in and pin it for their production. This voluntary cooperative system has worked remarkably well for many years. Oregon's currently in the middle of a research program studying the impact of growing canola within the valley. This has been a contentious issue, but it's progressing, with the Oregon Department of Ag overseeing the research and the limited seed production happening as a part of it.
Thank you very much. Sorry, we've got quite a few people who still want to be heard, but you can certainly submit it as written testimony. Thank you very much. All right, with that, we have Ivan Maluski, Amy Van Son, and Elise Sleegley.
You never got to meet with me, otherwise.
Oh, there you go. There you go. And then on deck is Emily Cooper, Joe Rodler, and Jim Myron. Go ahead. Thank you.
All right. Chair Fagan, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ivan Maluski. I'm the policy director with Friends and Family Farmers. We are a statewide organization with more than 5,000 members and supporters statewide. We work with small to mid-sized farmers, both organic and conventional, around the state. We are in support of House Bill 4122, and we appreciate that you're taking the time to hear it. I wanted to alert you to a couple pieces of material we've passed up today. We've sent you up a sign-on letter supporting House Bill 4122 that is signed by a number of family farm, organic industry, and environmental organizations. And I've also passed up a letter from the Provender Alliance, which is a membership organization based in Lyons, Oregon, which consists of retailers, manufacturers, brokers, and distributors in the food industry, serving tens of thousands of Oregonians, all in support of House Bill 4122. Just to clarify a couple of points, I've submitted written testimony. I won't read it, and we've included some background, which I think you'll find useful there. To address a couple of comments I heard, first of all, the bill does not have an emergency clause, as one previous panelist said. So there is, we've, unlike, I believe, the original 863, which did have an emergency clause, we do not have an emergency clause on this bill because we think that it's important for local communities to have these discussions in a thoughtful way. Number two, House Bill 2509, which was mentioned earlier, which was passed 2 years ago. We were surprised to learn that the ODA, just before the session, was now convening some rules. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to make their Rules Advisory Committee as it's happening smack dab in the middle of the legislative session. But to be clear, though we support the concept of mediation as an alternative to litigation, that bill did not solve the problem that those of us, including myself, who were on the governor's task force on genetic engineering, which the state authorized $100,000 for back in 2014, that 2509 does not address the concerns and the desired need by many farmers, and you've heard from some today, for concrete on-the-ground protections. All this bill does today is allow local communities to establish those concrete on-the-ground protections based on local conditions. And if a county doesn't want to do it, they don't have to. So that's kind of, I think, an important point.
Thank you.
I gather that I'm at my 2 minutes, so
thank
hopefully
you
read that testimony, and thanks for the opportunity to testify.
Go ahead. Okay. Hello, my name is Amy Van Son, and I'm with the Center for Food Safety. I'm an attorney with them. Center for Food Safety is a nationwide nonprofit public interest organization. We have over 750,000 members that are consumers and farmers, including tens of thousands here in Oregon. We bring a long history of working on the issue of genetic engineering on all levels of government, including working with dozens of states and counties to craft bills regulating GE crops. We've supported Jackson County in their successful ordinance, and we helped defend Jackson County when they were sued to overturn that ordinance. That case is now settled, but an important point to take away from that case is that when Oregon counties regulate genetically engineered crops, they are not prohibited from doing so under existing Oregon law, including Right to Farm Act. And the only thing that blocks the other Oregon counties from having similar rights to Jackson is SB 863. This is why, of course, we support HB 4122. All the farmers that are here have told you and will tell you, give you more stories about the harms from GE crops, including transgenic contamination, as sort of the number one to highlight today. Farmers have literally lost billions of dollars in this country from transgenic contamination. It's a recognized harm by both the USDA and numerous courts. So from a legal perspective, I want to highlight that this is a legally cognizable harm when you are suffering from transgenic contamination of your crops, and even the Supreme Court has agreed with that. That means that farmers have a right to go to court, seek redress, seek damages. That is why it's so important for government to step in. We've had a failure at the federal level for these protections, and the state of Oregon has also not enacted the protections that are necessary to prevent contamination before it happens. HB 2509, the mediation program, again, as Ivan said, is not enough of a protection to prevent before contamination happens. Mediation is great, and that program could continue and should continue under HB 4122.
Thank you very much. That's 2 minutes. Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
So I'll try and be as quick as possible. My name is Elise Higley. I'm a farmer in Oregon, and I'm not a politician. And as you can see, seeds and our seed supply and food supply is very political. It's amazing how much power is sitting in this room here. So I became involved because I heard about what happened with 863 and the grand bargain. And I honestly was just so astounded that I thought, I have to get out of my field and I have to take action and I have to let the community know that as farmers, we really rely on seeds. And this is what it comes to. A lot of people aren't connected to that. Our seed supply is the future of our food. And we have to look at the idea that 95% of the seed in the world is owned by the five largest chemical companies. So we're here. We formed our Family Farms Coalition. Hundreds of farmers came together and we said this is a really important battle to fight in Jackson County. We set federal precedent, and my mission and promise to myself was if we could beat that $1 million that the chemical companies tried to fight our measure with in Jackson County, I would come here to the Capitol and make right 863. And so that's what I'm here doing today. I want to just explain that this measure, like you talked about, that is supposed to be with mediation, I think that's all great and well, but the reality is we're also business people and we employ lots of employees, and to wait for a couple of years and then to get our seed tested and then to find out we're contaminated and then to deal with mediators and lawyers, no offense, it's not something we really want to do. We're just trying to farm and grow food. So no offense, Representative Rayfield, because I think you're a lawyer. Sorry about that. So I just want to say that, you know, we're looking for local government. We saw that it works at a local level in Jackson and Josephine County. But the good thing is you don't have to take a stance on whether you think GE is the future of the world or you think traditional crops are the way to go. You don't have to deal with any of that because that's not what this bill does. This bill puts the decision making back to the local government, and that's where it's been for 150 years, and that's where it should be. It's where people can't get bought out at a local level. We saw it happen in Jackson County, and we believe that justice and protecting seed is the way to go at a local level. So thank you for your time.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
All right, Emily, Joe, and Jim, and then on deck, we're getting very close, colleagues. Thank you for thank you, everybody. Your testimony has been very succinct. I appreciate that. On deck is Nitza Bernard and Natalie White.
Go ahead, Emily. Start.
Thank you, Chair Fagan, members of the committee. My name is Emily Cooper. I own Full Cellar Farm, a mixed vegetable farm outside of Gresham, east of Portland. I support House Bill 4122 because I believe that local governments are well-suited to make decisions that protect agriculture in their area. Agriculture is by nature a local business. We operate according to the local laws of soil type, weather patterns, and topography. What makes sense for one part of the state with regard to farming may not make sense for another. Windy areas, wide flat expanses, or places with many small farms clustered together tend not to have the natural protections against pollen drift that other areas might enjoy. Because I grow my crops without the use of chemical fertilizers or pesticides, I especially rely on regional seed growers to produce vegetable varieties that are adapted to our location and climate. Areas of the state that have a lot of traditional seed growers or traditional farms accustomed to saving their own seed need rules in place that would protect them from GE crops that could contaminate the seed supply. Once a seed crop is contaminated by GE pollen, those seeds can no longer be sold or used. Agriculture is a low-margin business, and this kind of disaster could ruin a farmer. At the very least, it creates a risky environment in which no good business person would want to grow certain crops. Farmers like me, who don't grow our own seed but rely on regional seed companies for robust, locally adapted varieties, would also be negatively impacted. As more genetically engineered crops become approved for use, more conflicts will undoubtedly arise. Local governments need the tools to be able to respond appropriately to these conflicts. Please support House Bill 4122 and restore local power over local agriculture. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jim Meyer, and I'm here representing the Native Fish Society. We did not take a position on the original bill, but when we became aware of the Dash 3 amendments, we took a look at them and thought that they were a very good idea. So I'm here today to support the Dash 3 amendments, providing the opportunity for consumers to know when they are purchasing a GMO fish is very, very important, and I think it's something that Oregon should do. Thank you.
Chair Pagan, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rollader. I'm here today representing Desert Springs Trout Farm. I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 4122 with the Dash 3 Amendment. Desert Springs Trout Farm is a private trout hatchery in eastern Oregon. We grow about 400,000 pounds of trout a year. Most of the trout are delivered live for restocking in lakes and ponds. Our customers are Cal Game, Mono County, ODF&W, and Fishing in the City in San Francisco. Our water is an artesian source that comes out of the ground at 60 degrees Fahrenheit. We use no chemicals. We use no shore power, except we have two 60-watt light bulbs in our hatch house. Other than that, we use no other power. All of our trout are triploid. Triploids, first of all, I want to make sure triploids are not genetically modified crops. And the handouts that I've given you will point that out. Triploids are made several different ways, but they have three chromosomes instead of two like a regular trout, and they're sterile. They do not reproduce. They grow very fast because they do not reproduce. And we think they're a superior product. We are currently developing, as I said, all our fish are stocked now, but we're developing a food fish market, and we've developed a fish that will grow on a vegetable diet. So we think it's very important that House Bill 4122 pass with the Dash 3 amendments so that fish are labeled, genetically modified fish are labeled properly. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Okay, we're winding down. We have five people left signed up. So Nitza Bernard, Natalie White, and Scott Susadale. Susadale.
Hi, I'm here. All right. Hello, my name is Natalie Reitman White. I'm from Eugene, Oregon. I'm here representing Organically Grown Company. We're the Northwest's largest distributor of organic fruits and vegetables, been around for 30 years, owned by farmers and close to 300 employees. We distribute over 100 million pounds of organic fruits and vegetables annually throughout the Northwest. I'm also here representing the Oregon Organic Coalition, which represents hundreds of scientists, consumer, producer, retailer groups across the state. And we are in support of House Bill 4122. The fact of the matter is the state of Oregon has failed to protect farmers from unwanted contamination from genetically engineered crops, which leaves farmers vulnerable to economic damages and infringes on their rights to farm with traditional seeds. Senate Bill 863 stripped communities of these rights, and in the last 2 years, the state has failed to make the substantive progress on GMO issues and contamination issues at the state level through the GMO Task Force and the Department of Agriculture. An unwanted transgenic contamination is a very real issue for farmers in Oregon, particularly those who utilize organic practices, which the USDA National Organic Program prohibits the use of GMOs, and for those who have a vested interest in exports, as many nations in the world have banned the sales of genetically engineered crops. Oregon is unique in that we are one of the foremost regions in the world for growing vegetable seed, and we are a strong exporter of agricultural products such as wheat and alfalfa. And as others have mentioned, Oregon is fifth in the nation for total organic acreage, which has seen a 93% increase in the last 7 years. I'll say for our own business, we've experienced double-digit growth every year since I've been there for the last decade. So there's strong consumer support and a growing organic market.
Thank you. That's right at 2 minutes.
Okay.
Thank you very much. And then final panel, Bob Olson and Tom Wolf.
Chair Fagan, committee members, Bob Olson with Association of Northwest Steelheaders. I am also here on behalf of the Dash 3 amendments to this consumer-friendly amendment, as a friendly amendment to this bill. And this bill does address an important area of evolving science. It's a valuable way to keep the public more fully informed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Fagan, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, the executive director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. I also am here to support the Dash 3 amendments, which deals with genetically modified fish. Recently, in fact, last August, the American Fisheries Society had their national annual meeting here in Oregon, where 4,000 fishery biologists were gathered from all over the world to talk about different seminars. One of the big subjects was genetically modified fish, GMOs, and the nickname we have for those are Frankenfish. And there's a great amount of concern about it. What I like about this bill is it allows the labeling so people can be aware of GMO fish and can make their informed decision. And we applaud Representative Holby for what he's trying to do here and support this bill and this amendment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, and I've called everybody who's on. Go ahead. I've called everybody who's on the list. Was there anybody else who traveled here today with an intent to be heard on House Bill 4122? Going once. Okay. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4122, and I'm going to carry over the work session on House Bill 4122. Out of an abundance of caution, I'm also going to reiterate I'm carrying over a work session House Bill 4058. To Thursday, carrying over a work session on House Bill 4065 to Thursday, carrying over the work session on House Bill 4106 to Thursday, and I already did 4122. That is carried over. Regarding House Bill 4138, Representative Whitsitt's bill, I just think that it looks like they haven't really addressed some of the major concerns that we'd have in terms of not wanting to interfere with criminal investigations and stuff, so I'm not going to carry that bill over at this time. And finally, since we did not have a lot of time to ask questions, if there's on some of the bills that we're going to consider working on Thursday, please email Victoria if there's somebody that came that you'd like to ask more questions to. I think she, particularly around the Capitol, she could arrange for them to come back, and we could make sure there's time to discuss those during the work session. And just please try to be on time on Thursday. I'm going to try and drop the gavel right at 1 o'clock if we have a quorum, because that is our last day to consider House bills. So, carry everything over. Anything else for the good of the order? Yes.
I just wanted to mention that my bill, House Bill 4090, had a hearing here, and it was on irrigation and water conservation in dealing with homeowner associations. And I am going to be asking the chair to remove that, and I'm going to be working with Senator Hansel on his bill, which has triggers of drought for this year. And then we're having an informal work group where we're working with homeowner association, we're working with Water Watch, and we're working with the League of Cities, and also the water providers to come back with conservation-friendly language that the Homeowners Association said that they would embrace.
Thank you. Anything else?
Madam Chair, I just want to thank you for providing this space for the testimony and reiterate my support for House Bill 4122, the underlying bill, and with the amendments. So, okay.
Thank you very much, and thank you to all who came and testified, and thank you, everybody, for being so intentional about keeping it at 2 minutes. That was very helpful. All right. With that, I'm going to adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness. Thank you, everybody, for sticking a little bit later.
We did it.
We did it.